listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Lynn Alden. And you should go to lynnalden.com, L-Y-N-A-L-D-E-N.com, to take advantage of a lot of very excellent work that Lynn provides free of charge. She does have a service, a very reasonably priced service, I might add, for investors. So this is more of a macro service that's free of charge, but then she applies her insights into the macro stories to investing, and that's what she charges people for. But boy, I'll tell you, just to go to lynnalden.com, there's a wealth of information from a macro perspective that I really find enjoyable and very helpful. So, Lynn, thanks for joining me again.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on again. Always happy to be here.
Oh, thank you. It's really great to have you. It's an honor to have you, actually, because I know that your views are widely sought now, much more than when we first met up with you, because you do such great work. I would like to possibly pick your brain a little bit on oil and gas, because you seem to have turned, I don't know if it's fair to say you've just turned bullish, but you seem to be pretty bullish longer term anyway. And then maybe if we have time as well later in the day, why gold and Bitcoin are popular is another piece that you wrote. And by the way, folks, those are two excellent pieces that she wrote, and they're not a couple of pages. I mean, they're very much in depth. The case for longer term oil and gas, and then also why gold and Bitcoin are popular, an overview of bearer assets. And so those are two pieces that I think are very much worth going to her site to read, as well as what we'd like to talk to her today about: record household equity exposure. That's her July 18th newsletter, and that's what I'd like to focus on mostly with Lynn today. Lynn, regarding household wealth, I think you mentioned in your latest report that it has grown over the years, over the longer term, I'm not sure what the time frame is, something like 4 times that of GDP. That's pretty amazing that asset values like the equities could grow so much faster than the real economy is growing. What economic implications does that have?
Well, one of the disadvantages is that tends to be negatively correlated with forward long-term returns. So it doesn't really tell us much about what's going to happen in the next, say, 6 to 12 months or even 24 months. But it generally is not a great sign for, say, 10-year equity performance from here. And, you know, basically, if you look, historically, the market actually, I mean, household net worth actually averaged somewhere around 4 times GDP on average. And so actually now it's much higher than that. So it's actually that, you know, it's over 6 times GDP. And so that's kind of a record. That's a record high at the current time. And it's been somewhat inversely correlated with interest rates. Basically, as we pushed interest rates down, as we've done lots of quantitative easing, we propped up equity prices, home prices, bond prices, all these different asset classes are at very elevated levels. And then even among those components of net worth, equities are also at a record high percentage of household net worth at almost 30%. And historically, over the past, say, 70 years, there's been a pretty strong inverse correlation between U.S. household equity exposure and then the forward 10-year returns of equities as measured by the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're very stretched now, as you point out. The equity markets are very stretched. Do you worry about any kind of a serious decline, or do you think the Fed will just keep pumping money into the system to make sure it never, quote unquote, never goes down?
So I think if we were to see some sharp pullbacks, we probably would see more Fed action. But there's not a ton they can do at the current time. I mean, they're not buying equities like the Bank of Japan is. And so their levers are fairly, not very strong. Instead, what we have to look for is any developments on the fiscal front, right? Because, you know, the central bank can lend, but it can't spend, whereas the fiscal authority can spend and then have the Federal Reserve monetize that. And so that cash can get permanently out into the broad money supply, and that can then boost corporate earnings. It can boost all sorts of different things like that. And so I would look more towards the fiscal side if you were to see a downturn than any actions by the Fed. But, you know, they would get more dovish.
Mm-hmm. And you did talk about a quote from Stanley Fisher, the former vice chairman of the Fed, regarding the impotence of monetary policy. So I guess when you get down to around zero or whatever, you can't go much lower. I guess negative interest rates don't really work, huh? And why would that be?
Well, because negative interest rates don't really lead to more bank lending. In fact, it can do the reverse because it gives banks a disincentive to really, you know, take on risk. And it actually drains money out of the banking system. And so, you know, basically that Stanley Fisher, you know, basically that was a BlackRock paper and they had Stanley Fisher involved with it as an advisor. And it's interesting because that came out in 2019 and that ended up being very, you know, high foresight in terms of what they did. It was pretty much, they pretty much laid out the 2020 and 2021 playbook back mm-hmm. in 2019, which they said, okay, the next downturn is going to come at some point. They obviously didn't, you know, predict like a virus and other things like that. So this is probably more severe than they anticipated. But they said, either way, we're going to have a downturn. And when that happens, the problem is that interest rates are already almost zero. And so they don't have a lot of space. And so they said instead what they're going to do probably is do a lot of fiscal spending. But that can be pro-inflationary. And mm-hmm. they said basically with debt so high, they can't allow interest rates to rise. And so they probably would have a policy of holding interest rates fairly low, basically coordinating between the central bank and the fiscal authority so that inflation runs hot. And it's basically, you know, step by step exactly what we've seen mm-hmm. over the 2 years since that paper was published.
Yeah. But again, with interest rates or with suppressed interest rates, banks can't lend. There's no way to lend. They can't get the interest rates they need to cover their potential losses and make money. So is this why we're seeing money flowing in the reverse repo market, and where does that stand right now?
Yes. I mean, that's, you know, last I checked, it was around $1 trillion. It varies day by day.
Yeah.
And the way I've described it before is that in some ways it's the opposite situation of the repo spike of 2019, where in 2019 there were too many T-bills, not enough bank reserves, and so the Federal Reserve had to start monetizing those T-bills, uh-huh. although they didn't want to refer to it as such. And now they've done so much deficit monetization. And, you know, partially because of the Treasury general account drawdown, right? So the Treasury has a bank account with the Fed, and it was filled with cash, and they wanted to get that back down to normal target. So it means they're spending more money on normal government, you know, functions, and not really issuing the bonds to pay for that because they've already kind of prepaid for that by issuing bonds over the past year and a half. Mm-hmm. And so they're drawing down that cash reserve, and so all of that is flooding back into bank reserves. But they have various, you know, SLR limitations about how much, you know, assets they can hold. And so basically what we see is non-bank entities are then pushing that cash into the Fed. And so basically we have, you know, more reserves than the banking system knows what to do with. Mm-hmm. And there's actually pretty limited Treasury collateral at this point because the Fed has bought so much of it and the Treasury is not issuing too much of it. And that has been compounded by the fact that due to the debt ceiling, the Treasury has drawn down their cash reserves farther than they anticipated. So they've issued fewer Treasuries than they anticipated having to issue by this time.
Mm-hmm. So are the banks getting an interest rate then? They're getting something, aren't they, from the Fed when they put their money there?
Well, it's a lot, you know, mainly that's non-bank entities. But yeah, it's closely tied to the banking system. And they are getting a very, very low interest rate. They're getting a few basis points.
Yeah.
And that actually probably has, you know, contributed to some of the strength in the dollar we've seen lately compared to other currencies, right? Because that's one of the tools that the Fed has used to try to prevent short-term interest rates from going into slightly negative territory. But it's a very minuscule interest rates they get in terms of profits.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, we've seen this redistribution of wealth. I would argue it started with when we went off the gold standard in 71, very slowly at first, but certainly with the Fed not having its hands tied to create money from, you know, once the gold standard was abandoned, it could create money and thereby finance government activities very dramatically. As I remember, I'm much older than you, remember the squeeze during the Vietnam War and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program. None of the politicians wanted to tell Americans they had to increase their taxes to pay for those things. So the Treasury started going into debt, and then the other countries wanted their gold instead of dollars, and we slammed the window. Nixon slammed the gold window shut. But ever since then, you can see debt, federal debt, personal debt, all kinds of debt. We've grown this debt so much so, the federal debt, I don't think anybody believes it can be ever repaid, certainly not in meaningful dollars. So it seems to me that what's happened is we've had a redistribution of wealth from the middle class, the manufacturing class, to the government, people, the lawyers, the government, the people, and corporations that supply the government with whether it's weapons or whatever the government buys. And then, so we've seen the sort of the middle class declining, and we've seen the elite class getting richer and richer. Is this then this fiscal setup? Because actually, as you just point out, banks can't really get money into the banking into the economy from the banks because of the low interest rates. So I guess the way to try to get money back into the middle class, maybe to stave off any kind of serious revolution or whatever, is just to send them money, I guess. That's what we're doing. And you expect a lot more of that.
I mean, it'll partially depend on election outcomes and things like that. I mean, it's one of those things. There are different ways to try to correct, the imbalances we have in the system. For example, someone could, just as easily do payroll tax cuts, which uh-huh. are very good for the working mm-hmm. class and the middle class. That allows them to keep more of their paycheck. And it's essentially, basically a way to, help moderate the wealth concentration we've seen. Basically, it's one of those things, if you look at just the policies in place, I think we talked about it before in your show, that the mm-hmm. structure of the petrodollar system mm-hmm. has kind of forced these trade deficits. And so the United States has kind of hollowed out its industrial base and its middle class at a more rapid rate than most other developed countries. Mm-hmm. And so this is somewhat of a global problem, but it's more so a U.S. problem in this case. And so there are various levers they can pull, and it'll partially come down to what they'll get through the Senate. So right now, I mean, Democrats want to do a pretty large multi-trillion dollar package. They have a little bit of dissension in their ranks, right? So they have a couple mm-hmm. moderates on board. And so they have a little bit of a gridlock in terms of getting that through. We also have to look forward to see what's going to happen with the 2022 elections. And those outcomes can certainly shape the magnitude and the type of any sort of fiscal spending that we can expect over the next few years.
Yeah. And I understand there may be some issues in the House as well with moderate Democrats who are afraid and looking to 2022 and worried that if they climb on board with the more aggressive liberal policies, they may not make it. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. So it does depend a lot on the politics in the Senate. Republicans would tend to not want to spend as much and probably go the other route that you were suggesting, tax cuts. That's sort of way to do it. What do you think the odds are of tapering? Because the market seems to be, it's one of those things. It seems hard for me to see any kind of significant tapering. We've seen what happens when the Fed has tried to taper before, with interest rates somewhat higher than they are now. But what are your thoughts? Do you think it's going to happen, any kind of significant winding back of federal purchases of securities?
Well, it's funny because partially I don't even fully know what the Fed knows yet. My base case over the past month is that they're getting ready to set the foundation for tapering, right? So they put in these two repo facilities that they don't need yet, but they anticipate needing in the future. Because right now they have the opposite problem. They have the reverse repo problem, but they actually, solidified these repo facilities that they haven't mm-hmm. used for a while. And that's kind of anticipation of them winding down their treasury purchases. They also had a number of Fed officials come out and talk about the need of tapering. And, basically we also have obviously CPI of 5.4%. Rent inflation still picking up, even though other types of inflation have kind of rolled over. And so, a month ago, I would have said that, tapering is probably pretty likely to at least be attempted either late this year or early next year. They started walking their remarks back a little bit in the past week because the Delta variant, kind of these re-lockdowns both in the U.S. and around the world. The Jackson Hole Symposium, was basically made into a virtual event because of that. And so we're actually going to get more clarity in 3 days at the Powell speech at the Jackson Hole Symposium. Yeah. That used to be when the market was kind of anticipating that they would, somewhat of a hawkish view, probably announce tapering. I'm less inclined to think they might do that. They either could have a date maybe later than we expect, or they could more clarify the conditions that would lead them to taper. Mm-hmm. rather than committing to tapering. So I'm somewhat of a, out of the loop as much as anyone else is, and I'm not even sure that the Fed fully knows what they're going to say on August 27th.
Yeah, seeing which way the wind blows, I guess. And it just seems hard for me to see. I mean, what happens if we get a 2 or 3, well, even a 1 or 2% increase in interest rates? I mean, it just, what's that do to the federal budget now, especially it's just growing dramatically. And they have to suppress the interest rates. How are they going to do that? How are they going to keep interest rates down? I don't know.
Well, one of the unintuitive things is that, you know, when they stop doing QE, we don't know for sure what interest rates are going to do, because historically, you know, sometimes they can decline in that context, because if you look at, for example, GDP growth, that peaked back in quarter two of this year, and now it's on the downtrend. So they would be tapering into a slowing U.S. economy. And so if you don't get that fiscal spending and you have, you know, a tapering QE purchases, we could get moderately high interest rates. We could see interest rates back to where they were before. We could see 2% interest rates. But it's hard for them to go too high with the economy slowing so much. And if they did, yeah, the Fed would probably have to step in and start to do more formal yield curve control. So that does remain a really big challenge for them at the current time.
Yeah, it sure would seem to. I just don't see how we get out of this mess. I don't see it, because it seems to me like the whole system is sort of diseased. You know, I mean, they can't go back to a free market economy, because it's just too painful. The whole system would topple over, it seems. So it's
I think overall, I mean, they're not going to be able to taper for the long term, right? So the last time they tried this, it lasted about 5 years. So first they stopped QE, and then they held flat for a while. Then they started raising interest rates and doing some quantitative tightening. Eventually that broke the repo market, so they had to reverse course and go to quantitative easing and deficit monetization again. And so they could go through a period where they slow down temporarily, maybe even stop for a little bit, depending on conditions. But next time there's an economic downturn, they'll find themselves in the same slot all over again, and probably at a faster pace than last time.
Yeah. I just don't see how it ends. I wished I had a crystal ball. I guess everybody else does too. But, boy, it doesn't. I don't see any happy outcome. You got inflation problems that have to be squeezing. I think in real wages are declining now with inflation going up. How is that helping the average person? I don't know. It doesn't seem right. And we only have a couple of minutes, three or four minutes left here yet, Lynn. So I do have to ask you about what's your outlook for gold right now and Bitcoin, because I know that both of those are asset classes that you're in favor of, I believe.
So I'm fairly bullish on a mix of gold and Bitcoin. You know, basically we've had a lot better performance out of Bitcoin over the last year or so. Gold's been on the weaker side, but you know that's a decent contrarian indicator, right? So gold's had a really weak price action. It's pretty undervalued compared to where inflation-adjusted interest rates are, right? So it's actually, you know, gold has historically followed inflation-adjusted interest rates pretty closely. And in the past few weeks, it's been a pretty weak relationship. Basically, if you look at the chart, gold would normally be higher based on where real interest rates are at the current time. And so I would say that, you know, gold should have reasonably favorable outlook, especially if the Fed delays tapering. Now, if the Fed comes out, you know, in 3 days and says, hey, we're actually going to do tapering starting, you know, in 2 months, and we're going to, you know, be on autopilot, then you could see a knee-jerk sell-off in gold. But if there's any sort of hesitancy or dovishness from the Fed, I wouldn't be surprised to see gold, you know, start slowly grinding up from here. But, of course, that's a trader's market. People can look at the charts and have their outlook for any kind of multi-month period. But I'm still pretty long-term bullish on real assets in general. So that includes all types of commodities. Mm-hmm. That includes, say, midstream energy assets. That includes gold. That includes Bitcoin. Basically, a bunch of different assets that are basically different types of hedges against currency devaluation.
Okay, because you see the currency devaluation is inevitable. What do you say to people that say, well, Taylor, you've been talking about this dollar collapse for a long time, but all the rest of them are collapsing too? So what do you say to that argument? What are you worried about, Taylor? Because everything else is going down, every other currency.
Well, that's why I prefer to make that view. I express that view through owning scarce assets rather than specific currency pairs.
So I
watch the dollar relative to other currencies because that does influence a lot of things in the macroeconomy. Different currencies can move down at different rates and at different times. But the defense against the fact that most fiat currencies have negative inflation-adjusted rates is to own things that have some degree of scarcity, especially things that are out of favor at any given time. And so that's my overall kind of protection plan against the periods of currency devaluation. That doesn't mean I want to own zero cash, right? Because there, mm-hmm. you know, there could be examples where you have, say, deflationary shocks, liquidity problems, and a lot of assets go down and allow that rebalancing. But it means that, you know, my long-term stores of wealth are generally in things that are scarce and useful.
Absolutely. Then we'll have to leave it go at that. I'd really like to ask your get your ideas on the energy space for sure. Maybe we can have you back to talk about that. Nuclear, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, anything on nuclear? Do you think there's any prospects of the U.S. becoming a little bit more aggressive in that area? Because it seems to me that would be one answer.
I'm long-term bullish on it. Right now, a lot of the demand's coming out of Asia, though. So we could see more U.S. involvement in the long run, especially if we have more energy and grid problems.
Yeah.
But really, yeah, that's a long-term story that I'm pretty bullish on.
It sure is. Well, thank you so much, Lynn, for being with us once again. Always a pleasure having you. All righty, folks. Well, that is it for this week. Michael Oliver will join me again next week, and David McElvaney returns as well. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
NV Gold Corporation, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in Nevada. With an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2021, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors, a globally recognized technical team, report coverage from industry gold experts, and a strong treasury. Visit NVGoldCorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.